It is time to talk money. And who better to turn to make sense of it all than Brett House. It's time for our Dollars and Cents segment with Brett House, professor of professional practice and economics at Columbus Business School and a fellow with the Public Policy Forum, the Monk School, and Massey College. Brett, we appreciate your time on this Tuesday.
It's nice to be on with you, as always.
We are expecting the budget to come down. Finance Minister Peter Bethlen-Falvey was speaking at the microphone today. I mean, didn't reveal much, but they did say that they're throwing a couple $100 million at trades programs to help training centers. What do you think is going to be in this budget on Thursday?
Well, the minister previously indicated that the budget is going to be focused on growth, creating the environment and the capacity for Ontario to grow at a higher rate than it has prior to the pandemic and fight the recession that may be on edge right now. So I think you're going to see a number of programs and initiatives that are trying to boost investment and productivity in the province. And you know, we're the economic engine of Canada, and as goes Ontario, we'll go the rest of the country. So he's in a leadership role in one way ahead of the federal budget that comes out next week, which is also going to be growth focused.
And so do you see the strategies being different with a provincial conservative government and a federal liberal government when you're looking at growth?
You know, their priors would be different. A conservative government would normally think about removing government involvement from the economy and trying to step back to let business do its thing. This federal Liberal government has been more focused on using the spending power of the federal government to incentivize and draw investment into areas that could boost productivity and increase growth over time. I think, in fact, though, neither of these governments are particularly ideological on this point, because both have tried all of the arrows in their more partisan or political quivers. They haven't done that much. So they're both scrounging around now to try to find almost anything that is going to boost investment and longer term growth in Ontario and Canada. So I think ideology is aside, and they're just looking for what might work.
And it's still politics at play, right? So Deputy Prime Minister, Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland saying that there will be inflation relief. It'll be targeted for vulnerable Canadians. Does that work?
You know, the evidence is pretty mixed on that front, and you're continuing to see a new set of papers coming out from economics academia talking about the potential that it may not. Or in some cases that it may. The usual presumption is that in an inflationary environment, if you put more money out and provide more support for spending, you're going to make inflation worse rather than better. But there's some evidence in some new papers I've seen that argue that that kind of support is helping low-income folks pay down debt that might otherwise be really problematic for them, maintain control of cars or houses that they might otherwise default on, and that can be helpful in ensuring economic stability and the foundations that allow people to keep working and being contributing members of society. So, you know, it's hard to say. It depends a little bit on how that relief is structured.
And it is our Dollars and Cents segment with Brett House. Brett House is a professor of professional practice and economics at Columbia Business School and a fellow with the Public Policy Forum, the Monk School, and Massey College. And we lean on Brett House to make dollars and cents of all of these headlines that include dollars and cents. There's lots of money to talk about. And Toronto, Brett, is facing a huge deficit. I mean, we're looking at $46.5 billion in financial pressures over the next decade. How does someone like you feel when you hear that?
Well, it's a gut-churning number. There's no question about that. I think the thing to think about here is there are multiple pieces to it. We have a big deficit this year in the 2023 budget that had to be addressed, and shortfalls between the funding we get from local taxes, from federal and provincial transfers, and the kind of services and the expenses attached with them we've got to provide. We are accumulating big balances of deferred maintenance on assets and equipment in Toronto. And with people moving into the city at a continued rate, and that's set to increase with immigration numbers going up. Those demands are just going to get worse. And we have, similar to all cities in Canada, a bit of a mismatch between the things we try to do at the municipal level and our wherewithal to raise money to fund them. And so what I think this report, which was produced by an accounting firm, is trying to motivate is a real conversation in Canada about how our taxation and our spending powers are mixed between different levels of government and how they might need to be reset if we're going to really bring them into alignment with each other.
And some of those discussions could come up with these mayoral candidates, right? We're hearing, you know, the province should take over the DVP or the Gardner, or we should have a fund put away to pay for these services that we're failing on. But from an economic perspective, we as a big city are failing in providing reliable revenue streams, right?
Well, we don't have sufficient reliable revenue streams. And the question is whether that is a fail as a result of the kind of division of powers in which we exist, or it's a fail because of a complete inability to deal with some of the hard choices that we need to face. I think the first issue around alignment of spending and tax raising powers is a conversation, as I mentioned, I think we need to have in Canada, because we are, notwithstanding our kind of self-image as hardy people in the north, we are a very urbanized country. So most of what happens in Canada happens in cities, and we need to think very carefully and intentionally about how we are going to support both with policies and spending programs and the taxes needed to fund them. But at a specific local level, Toronto has still relatively low property taxes compared with cities in the region, compared with peer cities in the United States and across the country. And that's been an explicit choice of relatively low tax mayors over the last decade or so. And that is creating an increasing problem where the taxes that we're raising locally are simply insufficient to fund the kind of services and infrastructure we need to be a world-class city.
Yeah, we have a lot to do, but hopefully we sort it all out before June 26, you know, when we get another mayor. Help me make sense of this headline, Brett. This is coming from the Toronto Star's business reporter, Clary Feinstein. Yet another bank has failed. This is a bank in Switzerland failing, I'm saying with air quotes here, because I'd like you to explain that to me, cracking under the pressure of rapid interest rate hikes. So the headline and what Clary is reporting here in the Toronto Star is Canada's banks are not as vulnerable to this global contagion. But what is going on outside of Canada, and where are our vulnerabilities with our banks?
Well, you know, there's a lot going on. So in the U.S., just to summarize, you know, we had two banks shut down and a third that was focused on crypto enter into conservatorship. The problems in the U.S. are poor management of interest rate risk and cash management risk amongst smaller and medium-sized banks that, because of an explicit rollback of regulation under the Trump administration, that weakened oversight for any bank under $250 billion in assets, they were not subject to the same level of scrutiny as the largest banks, the systemically important banks in the U.S. We don't have that carve-out in Canada. We apply regulation more evenly across the board, whether a financial institution is small or big, and the standards that we hold banks to are higher. So that's one reason why the kind of problems that you've seen in the U.S. are unlikely to happen here. Two, we have a very different structure in our financial system. We have six, maybe seven really big institutions, and the smaller institutions in Canada are truly, truly small. So if one of them were to get into trouble, the odds that it would cause implications for the entire Canadian financial system are pretty slim. The third thing to keep in mind is that Credit Suisse, the bank in Switzerland, that was forced into a takeover by its largest rival, UBS, the other big Swiss bank, has faced over a decade of problems, scandals, mismanagement, poor systems. And, you know, it's the rise in interest rates that's happened rapidly over the last year and the failures of the banks in the U.S. put Credit Suisse under the microscope. But to say that it's the rising interest rates that caused their problem, it's really just, you know, the last straw that broke the camel's back here. There is over a decade of things one can point to that has created problems for this institution.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me, because you always hear those stories where it's like, well, we need to brace for, you know, if interest rates were to ever go up, what would happen, right? We were always kind of living on a brink there.
Yeah, well, you know, like Warren Buffett says, when the tide rolls out, you see who's been swimming without a bathing suit on. And this is a case where they haven't had a bathing suit on for a long time. And we've known that.
Okay, well, we have 2 minutes left here. Inflation cooled. It fell to 5.2%. This is from Stats Canada. But credit card debt has skyrocketed, right, up to $93 billion. So people are having a hard time making ends meet. That's real right now.
Yeah, they sure are, because you've seen anyone with a variable rate mortgage see a massive increase in their monthly payments, and folks are having to rearrange a number of their financial matters to ensure that they're covering the most urgent and consequential bills that they've got to hand.
Is that swimming without a swimsuit on?
Well, it's swimming in a situation where the current might be sufficiently strong that it pulls it off, to stretch the metaphor.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Because it's hard living with that kind of debt. It's stressful. I think it affects people's physical health.
Oh, I have no question it does. I think, you know, a repeated stress like that is going to show up in people's physical health, in their mental health, in, you know, the choices they make in terms of investing in themselves, in education and other skills upgrading, moving jobs to a better job. All of this is a bit of a weight on households and the economy, no question.
Yeah, and that's why Money Talk matters. We appreciate you having these talks with us, Brett House. Thank you so much.
Nice to be in touch.
Dollars and Cents with Brett House. Brett House is a professor of professional practice and economics at Columbia Business School and a fellow with the Public Policy Forum, the Monk School, and Massey College. We always appreciate his insights here on The Rush.